Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Nicholas of Cusa, a German Christian philosopher who stood on the barrier, or just inside the barrier between medieval ancient philosophy and the modern philosophy of the Renaissance moving forward. Just a tidbit of information, he, after living a full, one of the things that he wasn't successful in his own time getting reforms in, which kept him at the state of continuously philosophizing, refining. So if he had been successful, a lot of this would have stopped. Everyone said, yes, let's implement, because people weren't implementing or fully understanding it. He kept on working at it, so we've got this big body of work. The second aspect is that at the end, he dedicated his library of books with a small grant of money to an old people's home. And the old people's home was kept year after year, and it preserved his books through all world history. And we've got it again, Nicholas de Cusa. So we've got his original library. And we know it's his because it's got a whole lot of hospice for people. This is elderly men has done it. So in terms of a time capsule, storing it, because it wasn't going to be known, there's certain people who did read his works, like Bruno. I don't know whether Kant did, but Bruno, really genius person to read it. Now, what's going to happen in episode 6, I'm going to read as much as I can, but I think I'm going to be stopped by 2.3.1, the icon on the wall, because that goes on for several pages, and I've only got a limited amount of time. But we're on 2.3 out of the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Symbols and the Philosophical Theology. That's this section here, 2.3. The relationship between on learned ignorance and on conjectures sets a pattern for many shorter theoretical works Nicholas was to write in the two decades that followed. The basic insight and framework laid out in learned ignorance is never discarded and never substantially modified. Instead, Nicholas's dialogues are briefer treatises, can be read as proposing many different metaphors or symbols for understanding his teaching about the relationship between God and creatures. So the entire thing is that because you can't understand anything exactly, you have to use a metaphor. And although you can't ever grasp anything with the metaphor itself is concrete, and we can look at that. That's a bit of a way out. Now, three examples of these metaphors may be give some idea of the power and the freshness of his speculative imagining. It is definitely fresh for that time. The first is to use the icon on the wall, the vision of God, 1453. The second is the attempt to capture God-creature connection by describing God as not other, in a dialogue by that name on the not other. Oh, that's what it meant. I thought that was what it said, but I couldn't believe someone would write. Can you imagine a book on the not other? Sort of Latin impossibility. I thought it was me going bad. The third is his fascination with mathematics and symbolic potential. While Kunis, which is Nicholas, never surrenders his initial insight that there are no proportions between the infinite and finite, thinking through these later symbols and neologisms, these are contradictions, neologisms, lets us see how these indirect means enable some movement of mind and heart towards the divine mystery with whom we are never connected. 2.3.1, the icon on the wall. Cusanus, or Nicholas, wrote the vision of God in the form of a prayer responding to the request of the Benedictines of Tergenes for a treatise on mystical theology. Wow. With it, he sent with him an all-seeing icon and proposed an exercise for the use to give them some understanding of God's seeing their attempts to see God. The icon was probably a Veronica, an image of the face of the suffering of Jesus, in which the eyes were portrayed as looking out of the picture plane. As a result, from whatever standpoint one looked at the painting, it seemed the eyes of Jesus looked indirectly into the viewer's own eyes. Thus it could symbolize at once both God's vision of us and the vision of God, the combined objective and subjective senses of Visio Dei. Nicholas begins with a warning. Quote, whatever is apparent with regard to the icon of God's sight is truer to the regard to the God's true sight, unquote. And what does appear when we place ourselves with the monks viewing the painting and reflect? Since it is a painting we see, what seems to experience as we look into the eyes of Jesus is not really taking place. The face is portrayed neither looks at on or sees anyone. In fact, the viewer's gaze is the norm of this experience of a face-to-face encounter. Yet, because of the spatial and temporal similarity of the apparent gaze, the art invites the viewers to enter the world of the painting and tends to privilege the what is portrayed, namely Jesus gazing at me. I move back and forth from my customary reactions when the eyes are looking into my eyes, from the realization that this eyes is contracted and illusory. Now, you've got to remember, this is pre-Renaissance art. We would do this pretty much with comic book art, quite like one. So you've got to understand that these people had nothing, had no photographs, so their Renaissance art was really, really powerful. They would see a picture drawn on a thing, and that would be the exact image they could see. It had no moving. But the illusory image, in the sense, is of Christ suffering and looking at me. If the painting is to mediate between my reality and what it portrays, it obviously invites me to look beyond, since it's an image of one who is the image of the Father. Twice removed from the actual divine seeing and being seen is supposedly to symbolize Nicholas's use of the icon lets us understand how far we stand from God's own seeing. Nicholas' initial warning also reminds us that what is symbolized here by the painting is all more so in reality. We are in truth preceded and embraced by Christ seeing us. In seeing, we are seen. This mutual relatedness is at least what the icon symbolizes, but Nicholas goes further, proposing that God's seeing and God's being are identical. O Lord, when you look upon me with your eyes of graciousness, what are you seeing, other than you are being seen by me? In seeing me, you are the hidden God, given yourself to be seen by me. No one can you see you, except insofar as you grant what can be seen. To see you is not other than that you see the one who sees you. Okay. In this way, God is seen identically, is identically God seeing. The reason is that for God to be seen by any creature is nothing else than for God to see that creature gazing. But the icon also reminds us of our distance from the seeing God. I can see the depicted eyes of Jesus even though no real eyes are present. But I... cannot see the divine face or its vision, even though God's reality is present and sees me. The dialectic of the divine presence and the absence of the human seeing and not seeing that I experience with the icon is thus turned inside out. When I look at the icon of Christ, what seems present is its seeing is really absent. Yet God's seeing is really present, though it seems absent. Good God, you can't really get it. It's just a picture. People, let's go. What the icon symbolizes is thus experience simultaneous connection of different levels of reality. Indeed, I have a separate reality as contracted image of God only through my relationship to my divine source. What is telling about Nicholas' version of seeing God is neither that the vision discerns nor practices one must follow in order to gain the correct standpoint for such seeing. Rather, he revises the meaning of seeing God so that God is both subject and object of our proposed vision of God. Yet this vision of God is merely purported. Canis leads us through a series of reflections on seeing and on the face of God, only to let us realize that whatever ratio or discursive reason comes to realize, God is located beyond both imaginative exercise and conceptual understanding. Nicholas symbolizes our approach to beyond by encouraging us to enter into a certain secret of hidden silence wherein there is no knowledge or concept of a face, unquote, characterizing it as an, quote, obscuring mist, haze, darkness, or ignorance, unquote. He invokes the coincidence of opposites from On Learned Ignorance, and on in chapter 9, the vision of God proposed in his second central metaphor, the walls of paradise. God dwells inside the wall, and the walls also symbolize the coincidence of opposites that defeats discursive reason and the principle of contradiction. Very interesting, some of the maths that we can come up with. Like, we can actually, chicken and egg, we can actually do causality analysis. I remember reading something in the Max Planck's Institute on that one. Okay. Just how to think through the coincidence of opposites and to attempt to move beyond the wall or to some sort of seeing God. Nicholas proposes three locations in relation to the wall map, three stages of mystical quest using the metaphorical couple of enfolding and unfolding from unlearned ignorance. Reason can understand things enfolded in or identical with God as different from the same things unfolded and created with the universe. At this first stage, we are outside the wall. The second stage is the wall itself, where Nicholas places us and Christ at the door or threshold of the entrance to the wall. Here, unfolding and unfolding coincide, and we encounter the barrier of consciousness, coincidence of opposites. At best, we acknowledge that creating and being created are one at one and the same in God. The third stage is beyond the entrance and inside the wall, where the enfolding and unfolding fall away, and Kodos points to God's silent presence and utter transcendence, quote, free from whatever can be spoken or thought of, unquote. The third stage involves recognition of God's infinity remains unknowable to us in conceptual terms. Kenneth proposes that some possible indirect routes that will give us no positive insight or conceptual grasp of the divine essence. For instance, if we look to the very oppositions and contradictions that plague the normal thinking about God, we may do more justice to the unique relationship between God and creatures. In his words, quote, the oppositeness of opposites is opposite without opposites, unquote. He identifies the infinite God with this oppositeness of opposites. And now the opposites in questions are ordinary things of our experience that are separate and distinct and that may have opposed or mutually exclusive properties. Designating God as the oppositeness of such opposites can take us from the distinctions and oppositions with which we are familiar to the One, which is God, who is responsible for there being such oppositions. God is distinct from these oppositions and the differences, but only in a way that establishes their reality. Yet God's oppositeness is without oppositeness, since God's distinctiveness is unlimited and therefore and beyond the familiar oppositions. In fact, God's oppositeness encompasses or unfolds all opposites in God, as identically God encompasses or unfolds all opposites in the creation by constituting them as what they are in all their determinate finite differences. We are to think together both of the finite thing and opposed and of God's transcendent oppositeness that is opposed to the oppositeness, not as one to another, but as then ontologically responsible for the oppositions with which we are familiar. Well, I must admit, my brain switched off halfway through that. That was just almost too much for me. But that's the contradiction here. There's the germ, germ. So let's say you're on a bus tour, and in the morning you just drive past the Taj Mahal. That's the way to go. The rest of the bus tour goes off in another way, but you can't go back. And this is my metaphor. And you remember that he, in this, where he's actually got sucked up into all of this questioning about what God is and real things like that, he's actually laid some really good scientific foundations. That's the end of this episode, episode 6.
podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.